And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Briand, Senior Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Equipment Editor for Golf.com. Jonathan, a couple weeks apart here. How you doing?
Hey, Professor, I'm doing good. It's great to hear your voice. Was that saying, absence makes the heart grow fonder? I missed you, man. It's been a couple of weeks. I know that you and I both have been busy working on other projects. Unfortunately, we can't just make the podcast our life, although I wish we could.
Wow, I wish
but,
I could
But
that.
Yeah, always great to be back. I had a couple people ask me if we weren't going to be doing the podcast anymore, so I guess they've just gotten used to the regular cadence of hearing our voices every week.
Yep. What is this, episode 30? I've lost track. I think it's 33.
33?
Yeah. So we're
Scotty, about... the Scotty Pippen episode.
That's right, man. So we've got a lot of great stuff to talk about today. We've got some mid-season changes for some primary players. I guess it's mid-season. I mean, I'm not used to calling February, March mid-season on tour, but it kind of is nowadays.
It is now with the fall. Yep, for
and,
sure.
And we've got a putter shaft switch last week at the Honda. Got some.
This is right in your wheelhouse.
Yep. It's kind of a putter episode, actually. We've got a really cool putter, you know, that Charles Schwartzel was using. It definitely has some similarities to another product that's available on the marketplace. We're going to talk about Armlock putters a little bit more in depth as a gear spotlight. Mailbag question. And for an interview this week, we got to spend some time with John Oldenburg from LA Golf Partners and LA Golf Shafts. You guys will hear a lot from John in the interview, but he is one of the most decorated shaft designers in the industry, and obviously, you know, was the designer who was responsible for the putter shaft we're going to talk about that was cited at Honda. So should be a great episode. But getting to tour topic number one for the week, mid-season changes. What's going on out there?
Yeah, this is an interesting time of the year, Tim, to see guys making changes of this nature, and more so one guy in particular. Typically, you know, when you're looking at about a month to go before the Masters, everybody's trying to get their bag set up, dialed in. A couple guys will make some changes specifically for Augusta, but for the most part, everybody's kind of standing pat unless they're struggling. But saw a couple of interesting changes at the Honda Classic. The first one we've got to get into is Billy Horschel. You know, Billy, back in 2016, he was part of I would call it a pretty significant group of signees that PXG made. It kind of showed that they were making an entrance, a pretty significant entrance, into the tour area. They signed Zach Johnson, Billy Horschel, James Hahn, Charles Howell III. They already had Ryan Moore. Billy Horschel at that point had three PGA Tour wins, one of them being the Tour Championship. He was the 2014 FedEx Cup champion. So, I mean, he was a pretty significant name. Well, Billy showed up last week at Honda with a polo hat on, and that kind of threw up a couple of alarm bells to a few people, myself included, who, you know, just kind of keep tabs on what's going on, you know, and thankfully, gotta love Getty Images, they posted some photos of Billy wearing a Florida Gators hat on Thursday, and it was a polo hat the rest of the week. So I reached out to PXG for comment, and they confirmed that as of Monday of Honda week, that they had split ties with Billy Horschel. Now, there was not really a whole lot there that PXG was willing to divulge. Billy, it looked like, for the most part, had his regular setup. Although, I know we're recording this the week of Bay Hill, I heard he's testing a host of drivers on the range this week, so potentially making a change to the driver and maybe some other clubs as we get closer to the Masters. We'll just have to wait and see. But Billy's an interesting one just because of the timing, Tim. You know, you rarely see players split ties at this point of the year, especially going into the first major of the year, and it makes you wonder what's really going on behind the scenes. Again, not a whole lot being said by either camp right now, but again, curious timing. Typically don't really see players make, mid-season splits from their equipment manufacturer. I actually kind of went back in the history books to try and see when the last time a marquee name made a mid-season split. And it was actually Patrick Reed back in 2013, when about midway through the season, I actually was there. I remember he walked in to the Callaway truck at the Byron Nelson, threw his bag down. He had a bunch of Nike clubs because he was a Nike staffer at the time, and said, make me a set. And they made him a set. He showed up, played Colonial, ends up winning at the end of the year at Wyndham. And he was a Callaway staffer at that point. That's the last time. But again, that's, you know, that's kind of midway through the season. You've already got a couple of majors under your belt. So this is again, a very curious one. Have to kind of wait and see what really shakes out from this. But yeah, Billy Horschel, no longer a PXG staffer. Kind of, we've started to see some of these PXG staffers go away from the company. You know, Chris Kirk was one of the first ones who parted ties with PXG. Then you have Billy Horschel. So, you know, Charles Schwartzel is another one that comes to mind. So some of the guys have been looking in different directions. A couple of them are still free agents.
Christy Kerr is well out on the LPGA. So we've seen some players make some changes. You know, the timing of this to me is the most curious thing. You know, 1 month before major championship season starts, you know, typically guys want to get settled in at this point in the year. You know, they're more ready to test product, you know, whether it be prototypes or just something new to put in play. It's typical for this time of year leading into major championship season. I remember a few years back, Rosie was looking at adding a 64-degree wedge specifically just for Augusta. You'll see players that are looking at specific pieces in the bag for course setups, you know, maybe a course demands to flight it in there really, really soft. I know in the past, having worked with Gary, was looking for a 5-wood that would land it soft like a wedge when he played out, I think it was Shinnecock. So you'll see a unique piece, you know, whether it's a 5-wood, a high-lofted fairway wood, a high-lofted wedge, maybe it's a utility iron, maybe something that's designed to flight it lower when you're dealing with, you know, going over to Europe to play at the Open. But you don't see a whole bag switch out this time of year. I can't remember ever seeing an entire bag get switched out in the month of March for any player.
Well, we may not see you know, everything get switched out, Tim, but I do think if he's testing drivers that he's probably going to start working his way through a lot of the rest of the stuff, whether it's just simply testing to try and see if there's anything better. But, you know, the curious part about this, and I keep going back to not just the timing of it, but the fact that Billy, in his last three starts, he had two top 10 finishes.
Yep.
So
he's playing well,
you know,
with the gear.
There's something going on. Yeah, playing very well with the gear. You know, he logged two wins. Now, one of them was a team event. He won Zurich, but he also won the Byron Nelson as a PXG staffer. So, you know, again, he's had success with the gear, which makes the split all the more curious. The other one that I want to point out is Justin Rose. You know, we had Justin Rose on the podcast. I had an opportunity to sit down with him at Torrey Pines. And, you know, he walked me through all of the gear that he has in the bag, all the new gear. You know, he's made a bunch of changes this season. He put in Hanma's new TR20B irons. Now, this is the tour-only version, but I've heard it's coming out at retail later this summer.
And that was an iron that he basically collaborated with them directly on, correct? I mean, he basically was in charge of, you know, helping them through the design process there.
Yep. No, he was. And the interesting thing, just to kind of go off the rails for a second, was, you know, Justin typically likes that pinched toe in his irons. And he actually found that the retail version of the TR20B, a little bit more of a rounded toe, kind of fit his eye, which was kind of a curious thing. So the retail version is very close to what Justin is playing. But also he talked about that the time that he spent testing Hanma's TR20 driver. You know, he took it out on the golf course a whole lot and worked with it in game settings. And he seemed to be really comfortable with that club. But he shows up at Honda with a TaylorMade Sim Max driver. So, you know, look, the great thing about the deal, and Justin talked about this when he signed with Honma, was the flexibility that they gave him with this deal. It was not 14 clubs. So he has, you know, maybe, you know, 3 to 4 clubs in the bag that he can typically play around with from other manufacturers to still stay under contract. So he's working his way with the driver, and he's one of those guys, you know this, Tim, you know, he's very particular about what he's looking for. And if there's something that's off, I would imagine he's probably still doing some more testing with the Honma driver. You know, went out and played with the TaylorMade driver at Honda. But yeah, it looks like he's still trying to work his way into something that he feels comfortable with. And for the moment, it looks like it's going to be a TaylorMade Sim Max.
You know, he was such an amazing ball striker and still is an amazing ball striker, really. But when you look at his ball striking stats the last year and a half, they've definitely suffered a little bit. There's obviously an adjustment period. I mean, he had spent 20 years basically with the TaylorMade team, so was very, very used to their designs. You know, this happens a lot. I see it happen a lot with players that grow up playing, you know, like ping equipment, for instance. The ping design ideas, you know, when it comes to perimeter weighting, offset, the materials they're using. What I notice is that players that develop around ping product tend to always prefer the ping product. And it's not just an affinity for the brand. They develop, you know, delivery patterns of the golf club that tend to work well. And it makes sense if you're using a specific product while you're learning how to play and it tends to do certain things, you're going to build delivery patterns for the club into the way you swing to make that club optimized, which may not quite work when you're going into a different brand or a different product. So I'm sure that there's been some lack of familiarity, even though he's part of the design and input team for the new products over at Hanma. I do know that when you just look statistically, the ball striking stats aren't quite as buttoned up as they were throughout pretty much every point in his career. Interestingly enough, the putting stats are off the charts. So he's kind of done a complete 180 where the putter is the strongest part of his game, and the driver and maybe the long irons were some of the weaker parts of his game. And in the past, I mean, you know, I remember working with him, asking a couple questions regarding the way that he was, you know, performing with a 3-iron. I'll always remember the quote. He turns around and says, I'm the best long iron player on the planet. And you can, what did he say? He said, you can take that to the bank. Well, you know, this is somebody that has supreme confidence over their ball striking abilities. And I know that, you know, it's been a period of adjustment. So, you know, the sim driver, as we saw throughout club test, we've seen it now through the first couple months of the selling season with TruSpec. The Sim Max product is just amazing. The Sim Max D, for those that need some draw bias, is just amazing. It's definitely one of the best products available in the marketplace this year. So I'm sure he's
doing well out on tour.
Doing really well out on tour, and it has a design concept that he's familiar with. So obviously, you know, it's him going back to something that's kind of comfortable from a design standpoint, from a shaping standpoint, from a sound standpoint. So, you know, I'll be very interested to see if the TR20 makes its way back in play at some point, and if it's the same driver or if there have been some design changes that have been made to it based on his feedback. So with that, let's get into our second tour topic of the week, which is a putter shaft change at the Honda. Yeah,
no, it was certainly one that I think probably flew under the radar for a lot of people. I know a few actually reached out to me on social media to mention that they saw it, and kudos to them, because this is not one that I think a lot of people are looking for. And that's Ricky Fowler switching up the shaft on his Scotty Cameron Newport 2 GSS putter. He went from just a standard steel shaft to an LAGP TP135. It's a multi-material shaft. You know, we've seen some success here recently, Tim, from players using LAGP putter shafts. I can't believe that we're talking actually about putter shafts, not driver shafts. But, you know, we saw Bryson have a lot of success with an LAGP product. And we also saw Kevin Na win with a multi-material shaft. I actually reached out to LAGP's tour rep, and he said that this shaft is actually pretty similar to the one that Kevin Na used to win the end of last year. So, again, growing in popularity. I think, again, this is one of those products where players start to play well with it. We start to see other tour players start to test it out. And the kind of the word on the street is that they built up a backup of Ricky's putter.
Yep.
With this shaft. Actually, if you look on Getty, you can see that the putters look pretty similar, except there's a Titleist stamp next to the white dot on the face. And that Titleist stamp denotes that it's the backup, because Ricky's usual gamer putter does not have that Titleist stamp. So decided to put the backup in play after he was struggling during the first round at Honda. Goes out and he shoots 68, doesn't make the cut. But, and this is something that we need to point out, Tim, he went nuts with that new putter shaft. He was more than 2.5 strokes better than the field on the putting green. Wow. So they're using the strokes gained putting category. Yeah. I mean, that is very significant. And again, he misses the cut, but if you look at the numbers, it just goes to show you that that putter shaft change, of all things, made a big difference in his putting. And this is what I love about having somebody with your expertise, especially since you are a putter guy. We haven't talked to Ricky. Ricky hasn't come out on record to say what the differences are, but you know, we've heard from Bryson. There's a lot of that has to do with the consistency, the shaft being stiffer. It's not oscillating as much. But what do you think Ricky's seeing when it comes to this new multi-material shaft?
So first and foremost, the gamer that he has been playing, he had felt, you know, having spoken to John Oldenburg just a little bit before we jumped on the pod, the thing that he was seeing some issues with both loft and lie angle, and seeing some changes in loft and lie angle between address and delivery that he hadn't seen before from his gamer. And so it just started him down a line of thinking of, well, what can I do here to get back on track with this? And ended up having a conversation with the folks at LAGP, I think probably with a couple other players that have tried this shaft. Here's the technical side of this LAGP putter shaft. By the way, we'll hear from John Oldenburg later on the podcast who designed this shaft. Basically, the idea here is to stabilize the head without corrupting the feel. So when we're talking about putter shafts, we get some translation. Translation would be like the putter moving very linearly back and forth, you know, not moving on an arc, but the shaft and the head moving in the backstroke at the same rate in the same direction. And so that's called lateral translation. And then you have angular movement, which would be how the shaft is rotating. So when you think about angular movement, think like a pendulum and the way the pendulum revolves around a pivot point. So you have lateral translation, and then you have angular movement. When you putt, during the initial parts of the takeaway, especially if you're somebody that rests the weight of the putter head on the ground, that initial force that you apply into the handle of the shaft will cause the handle of the shaft to move back slightly before the head. And when that happens, the face gets slightly closed to the path. And then when you transition from the backstroke to the through stroke, you apply a force to the shaft in exactly the opposite direction to get the putter moving back the other way. But the momentum of the head, especially with these higher MOI heads, the thing about MOI is that when an object is moving, it's going to try a higher MOI putter is going to make that object want to keep moving in the same direction. So if the head is moving back on the backstroke and then we apply a force to the putter shaft forward, what ends up happening is the putter shaft will lean forward. And a lot of times what will happen is the face will actually open a little bit during that transition. So this isn't to mention when we hit longer putts where our club head speed's a little bit higher, we may actually get some deflection. And I know it may seem like deflection or the bending of the shaft would be minimal at the speeds we're talking about. But remember, when we're talking about putting, the margin of error is so small. We're talking about tenths of degrees making a difference between making a putt and missing a putt. And out there on tour, that's the difference in millions and millions of dollars, possibly major exactly. championships. So yep. The idea here is to create a shaft that's incredibly stiff. So if you look at this LAGP putter shaft, at 36 inches, it comes in at about 410 cycles. What does that mean? When we're talking cycles, we're talking CPM, which is a relative measure of flex or stiffness of the shaft. It's not a perfect way to measure flex because when you look at different bend profiles and things like that, as far as bend points on the shaft, that can change relative CPM a little bit. But if you look at a normal putter shaft at 36 inches, you're going to be looking at around 350 or 360 cycles. Well, what does that mean? A differential of 60 cycles. Every 8 to 10 cycles is about a shaft flex difference. So if you're talking 60 cycles different, you're talking up to 6 or 7 flexes stiffer than what a normal putter shaft would be. The problem you get when you make something this stiff typically is that it feels horrible. It feels really bad. You can't feel impact on the putter face you know, through the resonance in the shaft. And so what ends up happening here is you have this really stiff, stable putter shaft, but then you can't feel anything as far as impact. And what John over at LAGP tried to do here is design a putter shaft that kept the weight, you know, typical of a putter shaft at 130 grams or so. Depending upon the length you cut this shaft, will make the weight vary, obviously, because you're removing mass if you cut it down. But then the big thing here is by using multi-material design, he's been able to keep the resonance of that shaft in line with what it typically would be on a normal putter shaft. So you've got something that's incredibly heavy, or excuse me, incredibly stiff, that's fairly average as far as weight, maybe just a hair lower than some of the, you know, more stable putter shaft designs that are available these days, but then feels like, you know, a characteristic that most players are used to. So, you know, we've seen this proliferation in shaft technology when it comes to putters over the last 3 or 4 years. I think it's an area where product designers are spending a lot more time than they have in the past. Whether you're talking Stroke Lab or Stability Shaft, now we see this LAGP putter shaft. As we've mentioned before, I've done some work with the guys over at Oban to provide some, you know, feedback on a super premium putter shaft for them. And, you know, the folks over at Acra have been doing carbon fiber putter shafts of different flexes and deflection profiles for a long time. So it's interesting because I think a lot of amateur golfers out there are going to say, well, there's no speed in a putting stroke. What the heck does it make a difference what shaft I use? But research is starting to prove that the putter shaft actually does potentially have an effect on some players. And so, you know, a lot of folks are well served to at least explore it and see if they get a different feel. You know,
and that right there is why we call you the professor, because I joke, but Tim is arguably the smartest guy I know when it comes to gear. And there's so much right there, I think, that the average golfer can get from what Ricky's doing. And as you pointed out, you know, it's certainly not something that a 15 handicap ever really considers, the idea of changing up their putter shaft. But I think you just gave them enough intel for them to at least strongly consider the idea.
That's exactly right.
Going out and testing a multi-material shaft.
Let's keep this in the putter world for the rest of the podcast. It looks like that's kind of where we're going.
Funny how that works.
So tour topic number three. I didn't realize that Charles had been playing this putter. This putter was put on my radar about 4 years ago. Well, not this putter, but a variation of this putter that's offered from a different brand.
There's a couple of them.
There are. And so this one, I don't know what the name of it is. I believe it's just a prototype. I know it's not available at retail yet, though it may be made available at retail. Tell me a little bit about this putter that Charles Schwartzel's using.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned it. It looks like a couple of putters that we've seen in the past. One of them that comes to mind is the Odyssey Backstrike.
Yep.
You know, that's one putter that we saw.
But the Backstrike wasn't available as an arm lock, though. It was just a conventional putter that
had a shaft insertion. No, you're exactly right. I'm thinking more just exactly where the shaft was inserted. And then another one that you brought up that kind of slipped my mind initially was the Biomech.
Yep,
Biomech. So for people, I actually got a chance to see this putter. It's funny that Tim actually sent me a text with a photo of it. I actually shot this putter at Bay Hill 1 year ago. Charles was starting to kind of fiddle around with different putters, and this one certainly caught a lot of people's attention. Again, just because of where the shaft's inserted. It's typically, you know, most putters, you're going to go somewhere between center shaft, right along that top line, mm-hmm. all the way into the heel. Now, this one is actually center, but it's all the way in the back of the head. And you know, the way the shaft is inserted, that shaft has to kind of swoop to get at an angle where you can, you know, as Tim mentioned, you can get it in an arm lock position. So we have seen it before. Charles been fiddling around with it. Now, he's no longer on staff with PXG, but clearly this is something that he has found to his liking. So he's continued to use this putter. But it is certainly a weird design. I don't know, Tim. I think this is something that, you know, obviously we always preach going to get fit in before you ever buy something off the rack. But this is certainly a putter that you don't probably see a whole lot of on the PGA Tour. I can't remember the last player. I go back to Biomech and when Heath Slocum was using it, and there were a couple other guys that were using it at the time. But You know, this isn't something that you're going to see a lot of players. I mean, even if Charles wins with it, I don't really know if you would see, you know, even more than a handful of players give this, give a putter like this a test.
That's right. It's definitely pretty far out there as far as design concept. There's a lot of engineering merit in the overall design concept of this putter. You know, I was first introduced to this putter design style quite a few years back down at Albany. We have a location down in Albany, and the director of golf there, his name is Lemon Grosby, and he said, hey, you know, I've got a lot of members here that are using this Biomech putter, and have you ever heard of it? I'm like, what the heck is this thing? And he pulls it out of his bag. He's like, I swear by this thing. I was the worst putter on the planet. Put this thing in play, and I make everything I look at now. I got to tell you, I've seen some really high handicaps with this Biomech putter. I've seen him try to use conventional putter. I've seen him try to use a conventional arm, what is a conventional arm lock? But I've seen him try to use an arm lock or belly or long putter. And then I see them put this Biomech style where the shaft insertion is way at the back or trailing edge of the head with a tremendous amount of shaft lean forward. And man, it has a lot of merit from a design standpoint. I've seen it really, really work with some guys that struggle with their putting. What's the concept here? Number one, it's going to be used in an arm lock method. So the shaft is going to extend up the lead arm. In the case of a right-handed golfer, the left arm, the shaft's going to run up that lead arm and almost kind of terminate just before the elbow. And the idea here is to keep that shaft up against the forearm during the entire stroke to add some stability to the head. Obviously, we can't anchor the end point of the shaft anymore, but we can rest that end point or terminal end of the shaft up against the left forearm. As long as we don't hold it to the left forearm, we're fine. And then as far as the shaft insertion into the trailing edge of the club head, that's a play on what I call effective MOI. And this is something we got to get Garen Reif on the pod here. We'll do it soon. Garen's a good friend of mine. And this is something, this is a design concept that he is a champion of. You have two different MOIs when you're talking about putters. You have the club head MOI, which is the tendency of the putter to stay stable or twist, depending upon if it's not struck in the center of the face or wherever the CG is on the face. So that's club head MOI. What's club head MOI going to do? It's going to prevent the face from twisting when it's not struck solid, and it's going to help produce a little more energy transfer into the ball when it's not struck in the center of the face. So it has a little bit to do with directional control, a lot to do with speed control. Then you have the entire club head MOI, or excuse me, the entire club MOI. Club MOI is different than head MOI. And when you're talking about the effective MOI of the club, that's something that's going to help that club stay stable while it's in motion. So the entire club as an entire unit. Stroke Lab putter shafts are playing off of this whole club MOI concept to try to stabilize the putter while it's, you know, moving in the stroke. By putting the CG or center of mass of the club head so far out of alignment from the center of the center axis of the shaft when looking on the longitudinal basis of the shaft, by displacing the CG of the head so far away from the center of the shaft, the effective MOI of that putter raises significantly. And what ends up happening is the player becomes very, very, very in tune with any twisting of the putter head during the putting stroke. So they tend to keep the face more stable to the path. And that's the design concept that's going on here with this PXG prototype and with putters similar to that Biomech. For all of our listeners out there,
have you
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, have you spent a lot of time testing these putters? I'll be honest.
I've spent some time.
I've tried the Biomech before, and it was almost...
They made that in a lefty?
It's difficult to... very funny. I tried out the righty version, smart guy.
Maybe you should just putt right-handed.
Just to get a feel for it. Yeah, I know. I should probably do everything right-handed at this point. We've had plenty of talks about the difficulties of being a left-handed golfer, and but you know, maybe this is actually a good thing because I couldn't get comfortable with the arm position.
Yep.
You know, that shaft just comes in at such a weird angle.
It's such a forward leaning angle. It's crazy.
Yes, yes. It almost gave me vertigo, it felt like, because you're kind of positioning yourself in such a way that it just doesn't feel normal or comfortable compared to a conventional length putter. And, you know, again, you get used to it, but I couldn't get the release point right. It was like I kept like burying it into the ground every time. And maybe that's just me, but yeah, it took some time to get adjusted to it before it felt a little bit, more natural in my hands.
One of the things about these types of putters is that adjusting the loft and the lie angle on these types of putters
is huge. Oh my gosh.
Not only is it huge, it's extremely complicated, way more complicated than any other putter design that's out there, to my knowledge. You bend that putter just even ever so slightly into that insertion point in the head. And, you know, it's kind of like a coat hanger. You bend it incorrectly one way and you'll never really get it back. So, it's a very difficult putter design to fit. It does have some technical merit when you're talking about both the arm lock methodology of putting and with the effective MOI of the entire golf club. I'll definitely want to know if this thing stays in play for a while for Charles. Has he used it over the last year consistently, or was it something last year?
Yeah, he has. He's used it pretty frequently. I would say that he's changed putters a couple of times. It's just one of those clubs for him, I think, that if he's not really putting well, he's gonna change it up. But yeah, I have seen this on occasion over the last year. So, but yeah, I'm kind of with you. I'm curious to see if it actually stays in the bag this time or if he decides to switch it up.
With that, I think it's a perfect segue into Gear Spotlight, which is arm lock putters. We've seen arm lock putters start to get used more prevalently out on the PGA Tour. Matt Kuchar obviously was kind of a pioneer with this putting method. Bryson DeChambeau is doing something
Webb
very
Simpson.
Similar. You've got Webb, obviously Charles. Do you know of anybody else using arm lock right now?
No, I mean, I think those are the usual suspects that we've seen here recently. I think some guys will mess around with it on occasion, but yeah, those if somebody were to ask me who's using an arm lock putter, those would be the first four guys that come to mind.
And, you know, when you look at wins out on tour, you got Webb, who's arguably the most consistent player out on the tour. Bryson has obviously had a tremendous run of success here over the last year and a half. Kuch obviously just won recently abroad and is also one of the most consistent players out on tour. And all of these guys, Webb is a pretty good putter. Kuch is known for his putting. So obviously there has to be a lot of merit in this methodology. What arm lock putting basically is doing is it's replacing the belly and the long putters that used to be used now that they're illegal. As we mentioned earlier, you can't anchor the terminal end of the shaft against your body or against your arms in any way. But just by stabilizing it up against your lead forearm, that can definitely assist with maintaining the relativity of the loft to the arc of the stroke. And when I'm talking arc, I'm also kind of talking about arc on the vertical axis, not so much on the lateral. So it's going to mean that there's less loft change throughout the arc of the stroke on the vertical if you have the shaft stabilized up against the lead forearm. That's number one. Number two, in theory, it would also stabilize face rotation a little bit. The one thing that I think is important to point out to the average golfer out there that may be listening, you can't take a normal 35-inch, 34, 33, 36-inch putter. You can't take that and retrofit it into being an arm lock. One of the things about the design of putters is that when a club designer designs the loft of that putter, which is usually around 4 degrees, they're designing it relative to the sole of the club. So when the club is soled, where the bottom of the club is flush against the ground, they're designing it so that the loft of 4 degrees is relative to that sole when it's in that position. They're not designing the loft of the putter around the angle of the shaft coming out of the club head. Now, obviously, we can change lofts of putters, and when we change the loft of the putter, it can affect launch and spin and all those characteristics of performance. But one of the things to keep in remember, or to one of the things to keep in mind, when we change the loft of a putter from its static loft that, is the standard spec, is that that putter is not going to sole properly on the ground, meaning that either the leading edge, if you de-loft the putter, the leading edge is going to be on the ground, but the trailing edge will be off the ground. And if you add loft to the putter, then the trailing edge may be a little bit lower than the leading edge. And that could also impact some of the mass properties of the putter, moving it either down or up, depending upon how you're bending it, which, you know, when you change the mass properties of the putter, that's going to change how the putter and the ball interact as far as any gearing that's going on. And you do get some gearing in the impact with a putter. It's not as tremendous, obviously, as with a driver, but you do see some gearing, meaning the ball spins in reaction to where the ball is hit on the face. So you can't take a regular putter and convert it into an arm lock. We get asked this a lot about, at TruSpec, you know, by a lot of folks that are curious about this. So you have to go into a club head that's specifically designed around arm lock putting. You know, typically the loft of an arm lock putter, if you were to look at the loft from a conventional method, an arm lock putter will be 7 or 8 degrees of loft. And the reason for that is because, right, you know, when you put that club into the playing position, you effectively de-loft the putter significantly. You know, it's a very difficult methodology to fit, I will say that. So, you know, make sure that if you're considering an arm lock putter.
Let me ask.
Yep.
No, I was gonna say, let me ask you this, Tim, just to interrupt really fast. Let's simplify it for the weekend golfer here, because people are going to be wondering, I think, after listening to this, should I try an arm lock putter? If you were going to try and drill down to, if you struggle with this, you should try an arm lock putter, what would you say is probably top of the list for those who might be considering?
I would say consistency on short to mid-length putts. You know, when you're talking
and
about...
What are we saying, like, from how far out when you say short to mid?
I'm going from 4 feet out to 12 to 13 feet, maybe even 15,
okay,
16
feet.
Yeah,
that's what I kind of figured.
And what I mean, okay, and I say consistency, you know, if maybe you struggle on 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 footers, but you have a predominant pattern where you tend to miss right or miss short, or you tend to hit the ball off the toe or something along those lines. But you may miss a lot of those types of putts, but at least you have some kind of pattern as to why you miss. Somebody that misses short, long, left, right, hits it off the heel, hits it off the toe, all of those sorts of performance, you know, characteristics, they would benefit from an arm lock just because it's going to stabilize the movement of the putter. It's not going to allow the loft to change as much relative to the vertical arc. It's not going to allow the face angle to change as much relative to the lateral arc. The thing that I would probably caution them is, if you're somebody that really struggles for speed control at longer lengths, arm lock may be a more difficult methodology to adjust to. Now, based upon physics, we can go down a rabbit hole right now that would probably confuse a lot of people, but in theory, based upon physics...
We're used to doing this. We're used, yeah, to confusing people all the time, Tim.
So,
just go ahead.
So if, based upon the law, the rules of physics, the velocity that the club head's traveling through impact is the sum of all of the tangential velocities of the radii from the head to the grip, from the grip through the lead elbow, from the lead elbow through the lead shoulder, and then the lead shoulder into the sternum. If you're using an arm lock methodology or a belly putter, you know, being used legally, you only have one radius. So from a physics standpoint, it would be easier to control the velocity if you don't have to time up all of these other moving parts. What we see from a practical application is that when somebody goes from a short putter into a, you know, in the past it was belly or long putter, now arm lock style, they tend to struggle because they just don't have the feel calibrated in to be able to have proper speed control. With enough work and repetitions, obviously you develop that sort of feel. But if you're kind of challenged to begin with, when you're looking at the speed control on longer lag putts, maybe an arm lock putter is not something you want to consider. So what do you do if you struggle with speed control on long putts and you struggle with short putt consistency? No, why not have two putters in play? I'm shocked we haven't seen anybody ever try to put two putters in play, something for long putts
now and that, something for short putts. That is an interesting one. Two putters. So you're saying to do the Phil Mickelson version, but with the flat stick.
There we go. I wonder if that will ever come to fruition out on tour.
Interesting.
Where we have a long putter for or a putter for lag putting.
You never know.
And a putter for short putting. With as important as putting is,
that idea.
With as important as putting is, you know, I would maybe I need to plant the seed with Bryson on this. he would be one of the guys that would probably explore.
He's got enough going on up in his mind. I don't think he needs one more idea. But I can't believe you didn't talk to him when you saw him at the Beverly Hills location.
We chatted for a while, and I think the both of us came away from that conversation with we both kind of presented some ideas to one another that I know definitely were a couple concepts I don't think he's thought of before, and he definitely brought a couple to the table that I've never thought of before. So I look forward to having an opportunity to circle back on that conversation. But, you know, the bottom line here, folks, when you're talking about putters, we've had a lot of putter content on the pod this week, whether it be a shaft change, a methodology change, you know, to arm lock putting, radical concepts. If you're struggling with your putting and you're losing confidence, don't necessarily go back to the drawing board and try to radically change your stroke. Sometimes it's as simple as just changing the tool. The question you have to ask yourself is the putter helping or hurting your natural putting stroke? Go to a qualified fitter, have them evaluate your stroke on something more than just a camera system. Cameras are great because they give some great feedback, but cameras can also lie a little bit too, based upon the perspective and some of the feedback you get off of cameras is not nearly as conclusive and quantitative as when you're starting to work on tools like a Quad or a Sam Putlab or a Quintic or a Blast or a Capto. Get yourself on some piece of equipment where you can get some quantitative data that will conclusively tell you whether it's better or not. Obviously, placebo effect is big when you're talking about putting. But folks, we're talking about the part of the game that contributes the most to the score that you make on the score, you know, on your scorecard. So to not pay attention to this is just crazy to me. Get fit for your putter and your scorecard will reward you. With that, let's get into our mailbag,
man.
Right. We got to get you next time you're in Scottsdale. I'll have to, we did some fitting with you when it came to drivers and irons, but we didn't do a putter fitting with you. So I think that needs to be part of the agenda next time you're out
here.
It's got to
be on the docket for the next time, for sure.
And in line with so much of the content this week on the pod, our mailbag question for the week.
I guess we're going to be talking about in mailbag.
Putters. Nate Dodge.
Big surprise.
Nate Dodge asked, he said, I just picked up a center shafted putter at a trade show. How many players are using center shafted putters out on tour? You can provide great feedback here, Jonathan. How many guys are using center shafted?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think in a given week it's more than 10% of the field. It's a very small number, you know. And again, just considering the putter is one club in the bag, it's kind of like the driver, where guys are a little more inclined to test and change, just because it is such an important club. And if they're looking for something that's going to help them catch lightning in a bottle, you know, you might see a center shafted putter go in one week, but yeah, I'd say probably no more than 10% of the field. You know, the names, it's tough to really think of any like currently that are using center shafted. I know Hideki Matsuyama has in his wide array of putters that he carries with him on a regular basis, he has a center shafted Scotty Cameron in there that I know he's been, I've seen him test a couple of times. The ones that really stick out to me, Tim, I remember Adam Scott back in the early 2000s, I would say, was using a center shafted Scotty Cameron, the Futura X Long. That was center shafted. Zach Johnson is another one with his Seymour that he used for so many years. I know he's kind of been going back and forth on putters here over the last couple of years. But the one that always sticks out to me is another guy who used the Seymour for a pretty significant win, and that was Payne Stewart back in 1999. During the U.S. Open. And Payne's win actually started kind of as we've talked about before. It only takes one win for guys to start getting interested about a product. And Payne's win in 1999 started a bit, kind of piqued the interest in the center shafted putters.
And Seymour, but, you know, I mean, Seymour wasn't really a thing Seymour. Before Payne won that Open.
No, Payne really put him on the map, and you know, Zach Johnson did as well because he won a couple majors with a Seymour putter. But yeah, you know, center shafted again. You're not going to see a ton of action on the PGA Tour, but you know. Every once in a while, you're going to see a big name win with one of them. So, still waiting for another significant win for the center shafted putter. But I mean, look, okay, we know it's probably 10% or less of the field, but let's kind of talk, Tim, about center shafted putters. You know, what kind of a player would benefit going center shafted versus going out, you know, a putter that was just, you know, anchored to the heel like a normal conventional putter?
So the thing about center shafted putters, by definition, they have no offset, and by definition, they're face balanced. When you're looking at offset and face balancing of a putter, it's basically where the center axis of the shaft is aligning into the face. And so when you insert that shaft directly into the center of the face, and don't do it with any offset in there. Now, we do see a design from TaylorMade this year where it's really the first design I've ever seen on a center shafted putter where they actually have some offset. So kind of interesting that the Truss putter, specifically their one of their mallet putters that they are offering, it's a half shaft offset center shafted putter. But when you're talking about zero offset, that's going to make a player aim the face more open. For most players, you do see some differences and a couple of outliers optically with the way that they aim. So the best way to know how you aim a non-offset putter is to test it compared to an offset putter. Make sure that all the other features of the putter are the same. So try to evaluate it where the heads are basically identical, but one's offset and one's not, and see if there's a difference in the way you aim it. Yeah, always test and always try to control the variables. If I take a blade-style putter that has a squared-off trailing edge with a line on it and it's got a ton of offset, and then I compare that to a mallet-style putter with a crescent-shaped back edge with no lines on it and it's non-offset, we're not comparing apples to apples. So try to make sure that the club heads are as close as possible that you can to one another. And the only real variation between the two is the amount of offset. That'll tell you what offset does to your optics and how strong that influence is. The next thing would be face balancing. Once again, you do see some outliers when it comes to the statement I'm about to make, but the vast majority of most players will close the face of the putter more at impact with a face balanced product. So if you're somebody that tends to miss a lot of putts on the push side of the target, you may want to try something with face balancing to help you close the face a little bit. There are a lot of things that play into the way that the putter face closes. A lot of it is CG position relative to the face. You know, some of this can be always length be and testing. Swing weight and things like that. But the toe hang or face balancing of the putter is a really big part of this. So, you know, when you're talking about why it's not more used out on tour, I can't really answer that. I know that typically players like to feel a little bit more face rotation when you're talking about the really good players, good putters specifically. Look at Tiger Woods and Ben Crenshaw and a lot of these players that are really amazing with the putter, and they actually let the face rotate a good bit. But then you'll find some folks that are really good putters as well that try to stabilize the face. So, you know, the biggest thing that I can tell you here is get out and test it. You know, test it against putters that have offset. And then once you figure out what's going on as far as the offset, then try two putters that are very similar that have different face hangs. And at the end of the day, you know, as we said earlier on the pod, if you're out there trying to play golf and put a score on a card, you got to make sure your putter's right for you. And unfortunately, what we see at TruSpec, a lot of times putters that players have very strong proclivities and preferences for may actually be undermining what they tend to do in their putting stroke. So make sure that your putter matches your putting stroke because you'll make a heck of a lot more putts and the game will be a lot more fun. With that, I'd like to introduce John Oldenburg to the podcast. John Oldenburg was the lead product designer at Aldila. He's one of the most well-known and most successful shaft designers in the industry. A couple years back, Matrix Golf Shafts was acquired by a group out of Los Angeles and became LA Golf Partners and LA Golf Shafts. When that acquisition was made, John was brought in as their chief product officer. So let's welcome John to the pod. And ladies and gentlemen, we have the honor of having John Oldenburg, chief product officer from LAGP, LA Golf Partners, on the podcast. John, welcome to the pod.
Thanks. Great to be here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So you are our first heavy hitter when it comes to the world of shaft design that we've had on the pod. We've had some club head designers, had some tour players, but you're our first shaft guy. So welcome to the pod. I hope that you can maybe share some information with our listeners that they may find interesting and useful. You've been at this a long time.
I have, and I'll try to share information and not get too geeky.
Yeah, it's always, you know what, our listeners on Fully Equipped, I don't think they mind the stuff that a lot of folks would probably not understand. I think they're a little more gear savvy than most, so don't be afraid to go down any of those rabbit holes. But if you can tell us a little bit about your background, you know, I know that you had a beginnings where, like so many different folks in the industry on the design side, in aviation and aeronautics and aerospace, and then you found yourself in the golf industry. I think a lot of our listeners would love to hear kind of how that whole thing transpired.
Yeah, going in the way back machine. right after school, University of Illinois, my degree was actually aeronautical and astronautical engineering, which a lot of people go, what is a guy with a degree like that doing designing golf shafts?
Right.
And I came out of school and I went, you know, I always wanted to work on rockets, and I came out of school and I went to work for General Dynamics in San Diego, and I worked on rockets. I was a rocket scientist for 7 years and got a little bit disillusioned with the whole aerospace government type work. And it was about that same time that I started playing golf. I didn't play golf when I was young. So in my mid to late 20s, people at General Dynamics introduced me to the game, and like
what's
a lot
your best
of
score
people,
ever?
Best score over is a 73.
Okay, great.
And I've shot 73 six times, and I still can't beat it.
Oh, man, can't break par.
Can't break par, no.
You know what? I need to fit you. Maybe if I fit you, that'll push you over the edge.
Yeah, you know, because I've been doing self-fitting, which probably isn't the best thing. Even though I'm fairly knowledgeable on equipment, self-fitting is probably still not the best way.
It's like cutting your own hair. It never ends up
that
great.
Yeah, my wife's a hairstylist. She'd never allow that. So
from aeronautics, got into getting into the industry, obviously a little disillusioned with rocket science and rocketry and everything going on at General Dynamics. How'd you find your way into golf after you started playing?
Well, what happened is an individual that I actually played on a softball team with at General Dynamics moved over to Aldala a couple of years before I did, and they had an opening for a design engineer. So this friend of mine called back to General Dynamics and said, hey, we're looking for somebody, anybody interested? And it was in the golf industry. And like I said, at that time, I was taken by golf. I was terrible. I was a 30-plus handicapper and an absolute hack. But I loved the game and was investing in new equipment. The opportunity to get into the business end and the design end of the game was just too good to pass up. Luckily enough, I interviewed for the job at Aldala in 1993. And I got the job as a shaft designer. And the rest, they say, is history.
And quite a history it is, actually. I think, you know, we discussed this a little bit before we jumped on the pod. A lot of folks may not be familiar with product designers, but the product designers that get all the fame are probably the clubhead designers. When you're looking at Roger Cleveland and some of these folks that end up with branded products in their name, I will say this, that shaft designers don't get any love. So
No, we get a lot of blame. We don't get a lot of love.
But your time with Aldala, I know, yielded some amazing products. Any of those products you care to mention as far as ones that you're really proud of that did really well in the industry?
Well, a couple of them come to mind. And of course, the number one would have to be the NV, because the NV was kind of, not only from a business standpoint was it extremely successful, but from a performance standpoint and the number of majors that were won, or just the number of overall tournaments and the number of tournaments where you would just see green shaft after green shaft after green shaft appear on the tee box and the PGA Tour.
I had one in play.
A lot of people still ask me about that shaft.
Right.
Where can I get them? And that evolved into some other designs, the Voodoo, and then a departure from the NV that was very unique and very popular with Aldala that myself and my team did was the Rip Shaft.
Yep.
a little bit out there as far as the graphics and the look, but still outstanding performance. And then evolved into things, I guess, one of the best ones I did shortly before I left Aldo was the Rogue.
Right.
And, you know, the Rogue was an extremely popular shaft, again, both at retail and several major championships were won with it. Jordan Spieth won 3 major championships. Every one that he won was with the Rogue shaft in his driver.
So for those of our listeners who may not be familiar, we are speaking with the Jack Nicklaus of shaft design here, meaning that John's product designs have won more majors than any other designer's product designs that's currently in the industry. So this is a luminary in the industry that we're getting an opportunity to speak with. Now, I'd be curious, you know, with all this time invested in the industry and in shaft designs, we've seen club head design evolve in drivers. We've seen it evolve in irons. And these are all technologies that you can see. I think for a lot of listeners, a lot of golfers, the tech when you're talking about shafts is tough to actually see. So therefore, it's tough for them to understand. Where has shaft design gone over the last 25 years as far as evolution and improvements over technology?
Yeah, you're 100% correct that it's difficult in shaft design to differentiate one shaft technology from the other because it's buried technology. It's not visible on the surface. One shaft looks like the other. That's primarily due to the rules of golf. The rules of golf say the shaft, it has to be straight. It has to be concentric. It has to be uniform in flex, in torque around the entire shaft. So it's basically a straight stake.
So if it's going to torque a certain way clockwise, it has to torque the same degree the other way.
In the 0-degree plane, it has to bend in a certain amount. In the 90-degree plane, it has to bend the exact same amount. And it's got to be geometrically symmetrical also.
Right.
So it's a tube. It's a tube with technology buried inside it that you can pay lip service to, but you really can't show the consumer. And that does make it difficult to differentiate product and to actually show the consumer and the player that they truly have something different and better in their hands. But what's really evolved in shaft design is the number of materials, at least composite shaft design, the number of materials that are available and utilized. When I first got back in the business, shafts were still, carbon shafts were still a little bit in their infancy. There were durability issues, there were consistency issues, and a lot of that arose from the fact that back in the 80s and early 90s, shafts, like even golf clubs themselves, it was more of an artisan culture. Right. It wasn't really a technology culture in the design.
So not as many of the designers had the formal academic training.
Right.
It was more so trial and error through 20 years of apprenticeship making a product.
Right. You look back at the persimmon heads and the way those things, they were beautiful products and the way they were sculpted. You know, it wasn't really engineering. It was art in those days and grinding wedges and forged irons and that type of thing. But as myself and a lot of my colleagues came out of the aerospace industry, we brought the technology, we brought the processes, we brought the materials with us. And in improving those processes to increase the durability and increase the consistency of graphite products that allowed us to begin to utilize materials that couldn't be utilized before. And there's a whole library of different composite materials. Graphite itself is not just one material.
I was going to ask, how many different carbon fiber prepreg products do you guys work with at LAGP?
At LAGP right now, we're probably using on the order of 20 different prepregs in the shafts. That's crazy. Within those, it's not just different prepregs, it's different carbon fibers. Right. Within those different prepregs, there's 5 to 6 different carbon fibers. And then you bring in some of the silica fibers, fiberglass. Fiberglass gets a bad knock because people think of it as cheap. It's actually a great material if used in the right place for the right reason.
Right.
And you know, then you've got some of your aromatic fibers like your Xylons and your Kevlars and your high molecular weight polyethylenes and things like that that nobody even thought of using back then that have very specific advantages and performance advantages, again, when used for the right reasons in the right place in the shaft. But as you stated at the outset, you can't see it.
Right. And which is a tough thing for consumers. They see one shaft available for $700 and then they see another shaft available stock in line in the product. And to a lot of customers, they say, well, what's the difference between this $700 one and this one that comes included in the head? I don't think they see the tech. So there's a perception that there isn't that much difference. As you and I know, there's a huge difference, and a lot of it comes down to these materials, some of these space age materials. What's that going to do to the cost of the shaft? It's going to drive it up.
A lot of those materials that I referred to that we are now able to incorporate, they are expensive materials. And right. within the classification of graphite or carbon fibers itself, as you go up in grade of material, which is actually going up in stiffness and strength of material, you essentially double the cost of the material right. for every step you take up. And you can take 4, 5, 6 steps up the ladder, which really makes it more expensive. And again, the consumer can't see it. We have to be able to explain to the consumer the type of material. And referring to it just as graphite kind of is an injustice to the product because, again, graphite is materials that run from $10 per pound up to $1,500 per pound. And it's all referred to as graphite, but it's not the same stuff.
Exactly right. So when you're talking about a premium aftermarket product, versus something that's available stock in line from the manufacturer when you pull one off the rack, what are some high-level differentiations that you can make towards the premium aftermarket products that are available versus the stock in line as far as tolerances, materials? What's the difference?
Well, I think probably the biggest difference is in the material and the design as it relates to the layup. And in the materials, the most expensive thing on average to control in a golf shaft.
When you say layup, you mean the way that the materials are oriented and layered together?
Well, the way the materials are cut into patterns, right. and then the way those patterns are oriented along the tool and around the tool.
Yep.
The most expensive thing in general to control in a graphite shaft is torque. So when companies go and they develop these inline products, that's usually the first thing to go is the torque. The torque will go up 1 or 2+ degrees right. because you have to take that expensive material out of what I refer to as the torque core. Also, if the shaft had some of the more expensive exotic materials in them for a specific purpose, whether it be stability, damping, maybe it's in there for torque. Normally, if that brand is then moved over to the OEM side, those materials are removed. The brand name itself is retained, but right. the materials in the high-end version of that brand are taken out. And then as far as layup goes, the best way to make a shaft, unfortunately, is the most expensive way to make a shaft, and that's to do it in a lot of pieces. If you do a shaft in a lot of pieces, you can make it much more concentric and much more symmetrical. If you do it in a few very thick pieces, you end up with not so symmetric, not so consistent of shaft. But making it in fewer pieces, it just makes logical sense that it's less expensive to do that way. Right. So that's where the OEM shafts also, the layups are different. It's thicker, it's less plies of thicker material rather than more plies of thinner material. Thinner material lends itself to a more consistent, more symmetrical product.
And when we're talking about consistency and symmetrical, you know, after the product is made, it's gone through its curing process, it gets onto the grinder, and then we end up with that finished product before we apply decals, and we do quality control tests. This is where that variation starts to show up, is in those quality control tests as far as the tolerances for both the flex, weight, and all the other performance features of the shaft?
From a consistency standpoint, yeah, that's one place it can show up is the stiffness around the shaft. It can also, again, looking at the torque of the shaft. Typically, if you buy brand A from a quality club fitter, a premium version of brand A, it's normally going to be significantly lower in torque than that same brand A shaft that's an inline OEM product.
It's a different product.
It is. It's a different product. It's got, you know, it's got the same outer appearance. And yeah, I'll be honest, I played that game for a long time when I worked for Aldila.
Right.
And it's a difficult game to play because golf shafts, like just about anything else in golf, it's a business.
Right.
And businesses are there to make money, and you figure out ways that you can make money. I don't think anybody's out there directly lying to the consumer.
Right.
Because they're not out there saying, hey, this is the exact same thing.
Right.
But there is a little bit of kind of pulling the wool over the eyes of not coming right out and saying, hey, this is different.
Right. This isn't something that LAGP engages in. You know, one of the reasons that we value you guys as partners is you focus on premium aftermarket. It's all about quality. It's not about these mass-produced pieces under these broad tolerances. mean, we're not seeing any bait and switches between one product that's available premium aftermarket and then a similar one with similar graphics in an inline product, which has always been great. And that gets us into the next part of this discussion, which is LAGP. Tell us a little bit about LAGP, how this thing came to fruition. A lot of our listeners, which are gearheads, are probably familiar that the previous iteration of LAGP probably derived from Matrix, I would say, and then springboarded into this new brand of LAGP. But let our listeners know a little bit about this whole evolution in this story.
Yeah, in a way, LAGP evolved from Matrix, but LAGP is a totally different company. When Matrix went out of business, an investor, his name is Reed Dickens, he formed a group called LA Golf Partners. LA Golf Partners then purchased the assets, the intellectual property and capital assets from the defunct Matrix and decided to start a new shaft company. And what Reed's idea was to follow a plan that he used when him and a partner of his bought Marucci baseball bats. And when they bought Marucci baseball bats back in the mid-2000s, Marucci was just a small cottage wood bat company in Louisiana. And they decided to go directly to professional baseball players and bring those baseball players on board as partners in the company and also to help them design the product. And it was hugely successful.
As opposed to just endorsing it.
Right.
They actually have a say-so. They have a stake in the game. And, you know, it's they're not only endorsing it, but they're using it.
They're using it. And like you said, they've got skin in the game. They are owners in the company. Yeah, right. They're not paid endorsers. They're not staff members. And Marucci, within a number of years, became the most used baseball bat in Major League Baseball. And from a consumer standpoint, beyond wood bats, going into alloy bats and composite bats, Marucci grew at least tenfold. I'm not exactly sure of the exact numbers. So using that formula of bringing the best players in the world in as partners in the company, and not only utilizing them from a promotional standpoint, but utilizing them from an R&D standpoint to help modify and design the product to do new and novel things. That's what Reed and his investment partners wanted to do with LA Golf. So LA Golf Partners formed LA Golf Shafts. And we're going to be doing the same thing. The two big things that we hope will differentiate ourselves from the rest of the very crowded graphite shaft industry is, one, we're going to have PGA Tour world-class player partners. We already have one in Bryson DeChambeau. That's me.
Love it.
I'll backtrack.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right. So the investor model, the player representative model, you already have one in Bryson DeChambeau.
Right. We have one in Bryson DeChambeau, and we've developed, me and Bryson together, along with the rest of the team at LA Golf Shafts, have developed some very unique new products with Bryson that he's having terrific success with. And the plan is to bring, as the company grows and evolves, would be to bring additional players of Bryson's caliber on board. Bryson is a unique player. He has unique demands from his equipment. We want to bring other players that have other unique demands for their equipment so we can have a broad, well-rounded product line based on the needs and the input from the various player partners that we engage.
And that's where a lot of product design, the genesis of it at least, it's player input from tour players, elite players, etc. You know, when we're talking Bryson, it's a regular topic of conversation on our podcast, Fully Equipped. You know, he switches stuff so frequently, it's got to drive you crazy, I'm sure. But whether it's on the Cobra side, the LAGP side with shafts, I know this last year he was the first PGA Tour player to ever put 14 carbon fiber shafts in play for an event, which is, that's something, especially for somebody as high a speed a player as he is. If you can get into a little bit about the creative process, the design process, just the collaboration with Bryson, I think a lot of our listeners would love to hear it.
Yeah. Again, Bryson, the thing that really drives Bryson from an equipment standpoint is consistency. Consistency and stability. That's what he wants. He is a player that is not very much concerned with feel of the product. He's concerned with results.
How different is that from other players you've worked with?
some, it's different with just about every player. Some players feel is extremely important that you can show them good numbers and they say it just doesn't feel right. It feels harsh or it feels too soft or I feel this or feel that. But you look at the numbers and the numbers are near right. nominal. But they won't pull the trigger because there's some sensation, there's some subjective sensation that doesn't fit what they're looking for. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, which is Bryson, where feel be damned, if that ball is doing what I want it to do, this is what I'm going with. And then you've got a full spectrum in between. Some players that feel is important, but it's not the end all. Some players that feel is not very important, but it does play a role. With Bryson, I think in talking to him, he would like to get a good feel sensation, but if he doesn't and he sees the numbers and he looks up and sees the golf ball doing yeah. what he wants it to do, he'll say, yeah, this doesn't feel great, but it performs great. I'm going to use it. And with that stability in mind, the consistency and stability, you know, in a graphite shaft, which is essentially a beam, it's a cylindrical beam, stability comes from stiffness. Because, you know, the stiffer it is, the less it's going to deform. And the less it deforms, naturally you're going to get a lower deviation in the amount of deformation right. if you have lower deformation to begin with. So we decided, you know, let's explore how stiff we can go. And with Bryson, that was doable because, again, he didn't worry about how it felt. A lot of players, right. you start getting too stiff and it's like, whoa, this is too harsh.
Too boardy, yeah.
It feels really boardy. It feels really harsh. I don't like the response. With Bryson, we didn't get there. So we explored avenues where in my 23 previous years of design, right. never went there because yeah. it didn't make any sense to go there. So we did some things with a driver shaft for Bryson that are very, very unique from a flex profile standpoint that had never been explored before and works very, very well for him. And as some people know with Bryson's quote unquote rebar iron shafts,
right.
Those things are stiffer than I've ever made. And we're still
stiffer than anything available.
Yeah. And we're still experimenting.
I'm talking about through steel shafts too. They're the stiffest iron shafts you could possibly conceive of playing. It's pretty wild. You know, there's that perception out there that carbon fiber iron shafts are for grandpa. Not these.
No. Grandpa would hurt himself hitting yeah. these things. But again, with Bryson, we're exploring going even further because he has felt that he got such a good increase in his desired performance going this stiff. What happens if we go even stiffer?
Yep.
So I've got rebar plus irons back in my office, you know, ready for him to try.
You have actual rebar down them?
Don't have rebar down. That's the great thing about, again, graphite or carbon fiber is it's a huge library of material. Right. So it's 100% carbon fiber shaft. It's just different types of stiffer carbon fiber.
Yep. Well, you know, when you're talking about LAGP product, we know that some of it was imported from the old Matrix lines, the legacy lines. And I think that there's going to be a concerted effort here in 2020 from what you discussed to really establish, LAGP wants to establish its own identity as far as brand and cut ties with some of that legacy product. So what are we going to see out of LAGP as far as products going forward?
We've got a new exciting product launch coming up this month, and it will be new products, the product that was developed with Bryson for his driver, which we're referring to as the Trono product. And again, a very, very unique flex profile made for really the modern high-speed athletic golfer. And we have another new product coming out called the Olus. And Olus, I'll be a little egotistical here. Olus stands for Ole's Signature Series. You know, through my career, people in the industry have known me as Ole.
Yep.
So it's a shaft based off of product that in my design career has historically performed very, very well. You know, I'm talking major championship winning type product. And this is just an evolution off of what I've done in my previous career. We'll have that. And then we'll have a line of product called Tour Axis. And Tour Axis evolved from, but really isn't old Matrix product. Yeah, it's product that we've redesigned, re-engineered, kind of baselined off of some of the very successful Matrix product of the past to come out with a brand new LA Golf product line, not a revised Matrix product line, but a brand new LA Golf product line that is very, very consumer friendly, very, very fitter friendly as far as offering several options right. for the consumer to get the ball flight that they need.
You mentioned to me in evaluating some of those legacy products that carried over that there was maybe a little more overlap between a few of these products that you had initially thought there would be. And so one of the ideas with the Tour Access products is to differentiate them even more, make the high ball flight stuff really high ball flight, make the low ball flight stuff really low ball flight. That was a very interesting conversation earlier that I think is going to really help a lot of golfers who try LAGP product. You know, we see this at TruSpec that, you know, so much of the marketplace is focused on the biggest section of the bell curve as far as product design. And we see so much overlap in products that we really have to look at products that are well outside those parameters as far as performance. So I'm really excited to get those in and work with those, let our fitters work with them. I'd be curious to hear from you. You know, you've been around the premium equipment world for a long time now. What would be the one piece of advice you'd give the average amateur out there that's looking to upgrade their current equipment, specifically related to the shafts that they're playing, whether it be in their graphite woods or through their irons as well?
Well, the first and most obvious thing is get fitted by a qualified fitter, you know, through a great organization like TruSpec. Because you know, we spoke a little bit earlier when we were talking about our personal golf games, and you know, I've been basically self-fitting myself for years because yeah. I think I know what I'm doing. I really don't. I know product.
You know shaft product.
I know
for sure,
shaft I'm, product. Yeah. yeah, and I know heads and grips pretty well. But right. you know, anybody should go through a proper fitting. One of the you know, I've been asked to do a lot of presentations through the years on shafts and shaft technology, and golf in general, and the one thing that I've always said, if there's 20 million golfers in the United States, there's 20 million different ways to swing a golf club. So
amen to that.
Yeah, you cannot just go up to a shelf and grab something because it works for your buddy. Right. Because you do not have the same swing. You may have similar swings, but you don't have the same swing. You need something specifically built for you. The golf head, shaft, and grip are a system. And it's the combination of those three parts that form this system that you need to make sure the system is tailored for the way you swing the golf club. And, you know, if there's one general piece of philosophy I've learned for your average golfer is don't let your ego get in the way when you're being fit. Don't try to steer your fitter into a certain product. If you fit into a regular flex or a senior flex, play a regular flex or a senior flex. I've always told people, play the softest flex that you can control adequately, because that's going to give you the best benefit. You know, if you're a 45-year-old guy saying, well, no, I play stiff. Don't do that. Right. You know, don't let your ego get in the way of a proper fitting. Listen to the fitter. Look at the numbers. Watch what the golf ball does and use the equipment that best fits you, regardless of the brand or regardless of the flex.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Oldenburg, LA Golf Partners, thanks for coming on the pod. This has been great.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Thanks. Looking forward to having you on again soon. Thanks a lot.
And that'll do it for episode 33 of Fully Equipped. Big thanks to John Oldenburg for joining us on the podcast this week. If you want to get more gear news from myself and Tim, make sure you check out our social feeds. We're at @fully_equipped on Twitter and @fullyequippedgolf on Instagram. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week.